from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Academic redshirting is becoming more common. Parents choosing to hold a child back for an extra year before the start of kindergarten because they don't think their child is ready for the academic, social, or emotional demands of kindergarten. Or, say critics, because they're looking for an unwarranted disruptive advantage. But is it an advantage in the long run? And what does it mean for classmates, for teachers? This hour, On Point, academic redshirting and the delayed start to schooling. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you redshirted your child, held them back from the start of kindergarten for a year, seen it done, seen an advantage, a disadvantage? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of a kindergarten class, Syracuse Academy Charter School in Syracuse, New York, singing one of their classroom calendar songs.
January, February, March, April, May, June, July.
Just to remember the sound of kindergartners. They're very young, but is it five or six? Here's from 60 Minutes. Deirdre Naffern, their producer there, talked with her employer about the struggle she was having over whether or not to redshirt her four-year-old son, who was healthy but born premature.
There's this fear in the back of my mind that he's already a little bit disadvantaged because he's a little bit smaller than everybody else. And who knows, will putting him in his normal class kind of perpetuate that, keep him smaller, keep him a little bit behind, maybe keep him less confident.
People are redshirting, holding their kids back for all kinds of reasons these days. Joining us first today from Washington is Sarah Mead. She writes for Education Week, focusing on early childhood education, senior associate with the nonprofit analysis and consulting outfit Bellwether Education Partners. Sarah Mead, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
I'm trying to get a sense of how many American children are held back from the standard five-year-old start of kindergarten. And I have to say, it's hard to say. I've seen 6%. I've seen 9%. I've seen 2% in poorer school districts and up to 27% in wealthier ones. What's your sense of how common this is now, Sarah?
So national data from the National Center for Education Statistics say that about 9% of kids start kindergarten when they're 6 years old or over, and more than half of children are already 5.5 or older when they start kindergarten. Now, that's partly something that occurs because of decisions that parents make, but it's also something that occurs because of state policy. Over the past couple decades, states have been moving up the cutoff date by which children have to turn 5 in order to start kindergarten. And so there are now at least 6 states in which children actually have to be 5 before the beginning of August in order to start kindergarten that year. And over 30 states require children to be 5 before September 1st or on September 1st. And so that's also a factor that's driving up the age at which children enter kindergarten.
Why are schools, school districts, states driving up the age at which children are required to start school?
So this is a trend that has been unfolding over time, and several states have taken action on this in the past year or so. One of the reasons is that there are concerns about really wide ranges in development of children in kindergarten classrooms in schools that had in states or districts that had later cutoffs. So, for example, Connecticut has the latest cutoff, which is January 1st, and so in a classroom there, you could have a child who is, you know, won't turn 5 for another 4 months, but you could also have children whose parents had decided to hold them back a year. So you could have an 18-month difference in children's ages, which would be, you know, quite a challenge for a teacher to manage that big a difference.
So you'd have someone ages. Coming into school, they'd actually be 4 years old starting kindergarten, and someone else who's 6-plus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even with that, the trend towards states saying, well, let them be older when they start, parents are still holding back. What are the main motivators, Sarah?
So only about 6% of kindergartners are actually entering in a delayed entry, which would be sort of the year after they were eligible to enter. So while we hear a lot about this trend, mm-hmm. it's still only about 1 in 20 kids. And there's not a lot of research on the specific reasons that parents might choose to do this. A lot of it is anecdotal. But, you know, parents anecdotally are choosing to make this decision based on, concerns about whether their children are ready for the academics, whether their children are ready for the social requirements, you know, being able to sit still, and follow sort of the behavior norms that schools expect of young children, particularly for little boys who tend to develop mentally on average, be a few months behind girls on some of those skills. The other thing to keep in mind here is that in most states, the age of compulsory school attendance is 6 or in some states even higher, 7 or 8. So for the most part, parents are not required to enroll their children in school when they're 5. And most states also don't make kindergarten mandatory at all.
Are people holding their kids back because kindergarten has changed? It's become, somehow more academic, more difficult if you're not ready for it? Or are they holding them back because the competition for advantage has become more pressing or something else?
I mean, given that this is a hard question to answer in an empirical research-based way, so most of the reports are anecdotal, and there are definitely anecdotal reports of parents holding children back for both of those reasons. I think a third issue is around the social-emotional development piece and children's behavior. Some children may be, academically ready for kindergarten, but may have a lot of challenges with things like sitting still, paying attention all the time, and sometimes parents make decisions based on concerns about that issue as well.
All right. And when it's advantage, what are they looking for, and what do the studies show? Is it an advantage to start kindergarten later? Does it produce a winner?
So it's not entirely clear that parents who are making this decision to give their children an advantage are necessarily achieving their goal. While research suggests there are some short-term advantages in terms of achievement for children who are a little bit older when they start kindergarten for the first time, over the long term, those advantages fade out pretty quickly. And later on the program, you'll have a researcher on who will talk about some research that shows that being retained or starting kindergarten later actually leads to a higher likelihood of lower educational attainment, can reduce earnings at grade 30, and reduces lifetime earnings too.
So you don't have proof that this actually works out. We'll look more closely at the research. What about the big swing between percentages of people doing this? We're looking at these Connecticut numbers where 2% in poorer school districts and 27% in wealthier districts holding the kids back to start at an older age. Why that huge gap?
Well, Connecticut is a real outlier state to be looking at here because their start date for kindergarten entry is so late. Children can turn 5 as late as January 1st and still be eligible for kindergarten entry. I suspect
still everybody has to operate under those rules, and the difference between poor and wealthy is enormous.
What I'm not sure is whether that's representative of differences in the rate of at which children are held are delayed kindergarten entry in other states. Parents are more likely to make that decision if their children are much younger.
Poor children and rich children would fall
held back might not even be eligible to enter kindergarten.
There's no difference in poor and rich children in terms of the ages that there will be, but there's a great difference in terms of the percentage being held back. Is that just because the poor can't afford another year of preschool child care?
I mean, we don't actually know what the reason is because there's no empirical research on it, but obviously parents who have more resources are better able to pay for an additional year of pre-K or of child care than more affluent parents. If you look at national data, there is some data from the national figures showing that more affluent, more educated parents are also more likely to delay their children's kindergarten entry, but the difference is not as large as it is in the Connecticut data. It's about 7 or 8% of the more affluent parents compared to 4% of the lowest income parents, and for sort of the low moderate income families, there's not that big a difference.
And when it comes to the controversy around this, Sarah, is it other parents complaining that some parents are seeking unfair advantage for their kids, holding them back? Is it teachers saying, how do I teach a class that has 4-year-olds and almost 7-year-olds in it at the same time?
I mean, I do think that it is very challenging for teachers to teach classes where there's a really wide range in children's development. I also just think you know, culturally, there's a lot of emphasis right now in the public debate on, you know, judging parents' choices that they make about their children, and that infuses this conversation as well.
Do you see this trend continuing to go up? I mean, it clearly looks like there are more kids being held back than there were at one time. Are we still on an uptrend here, or are people falling out of love with? I mean, there was a time I can remember when parents were proud to have children jumping ahead in class. That, you know, they'd skip third grade, and that would be a source of delight and boasting.
We definitely have seen a trend in terms of states moving up their entry cutoffs for kindergarten, and I think one of the questions is, you know, how will that impact trends on kindergarten redshirting, given that, you know, in some cases, if the birthday is relatively late, parents, if the cutoff date is later in the year, you know, parents are more likely to look at their child who has a birthday between an earlier cutoff and a later cutoff and say, gosh, I'm not sure you're ready, then they might be, you know, in a state with an earlier cutoff where the child would already be older when they got to the cutoff.
Sarah Mead with Education Week. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Sarah.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about academic redshirting, as it's called, families holding their young children back from starting kindergarten. There is controversy around it, and also basic question of whether or not it's a good idea. That may boil down to the individual child, but there are trends here as well. More people doing it. We'll go to the research. We'll go to a mother who's done it. With us right now from Washington is Rhianne Evans-Alvin. She's Executive Director of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Rhianne Evans-Alvin, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Here's just a little sample of the kind of response we're getting on Facebook and online, Rhianne. Pat says, my youngest daughter had a borderline birthday. I held her back a year. She ended up being co-valedictorian of her high school class. She's now 30. Pat's very happy. Phyllis says, I would have benefited from being redshirted. My October birthday allowed me to start kindergarten at 4, so I was younger, less mature, was always a little bit behind. And then, Rhianne, here's Mel says, I started my kid a year early. At age 4 3/4, he was so ready. Excelling was never a question for him. There's a whole range. What do you see, and why is your group not so keen on redshirting, Rhianne?
Well, first off, I think parents, it's a very emotional decision for parents, and especially given the recent discussions and the fervor around academic rigor, around standards and accountability, and what's the expectation of children and families and schools to perform, I think it heightens the fervor around these kinds of decisions that parents are making. And so, as Sarah said, the research is varied on this, but it doesn't account for parents having to make those individual decisions. Children who are 5, there's a lot of variability in their development. Children who are 5 1/2, children who are 4. I mean, think about a 5-year-old. It's 20% of their life is 1 year.
Yeah.
And so kindergarten teachers, it's a transition year for children. And some children, you think of a class of 20 kindergartners, some of them are coming to that class with really, really great early childhood experiences, early learning experiences, and some are not. And kindergarten teachers, for the most part, they're expecting that variation, and I would say are, again, for the most part, equipped to deal with the variation. So I think it's important as parents are making those decisions to think, you know, there's one thing you're guaranteed if you decide to keep your child out of school, and that is that they're going to be 1 year older when they start. There's no guarantee on academic performance, certainly on IQ, but it's a tough decision for parents.
I was 4 when my parents sent me off to school, one of the youngest kids in the class. I never thought twice about it. I don't know if people did think as much about it in those days. You're saying it's more freighted these days because, what, the sense of stakes is higher, the competition is keener, or is this because families are thinking, oh, you know, we want our son to be the big football player 12 years from now or 10 years from now in high school, so let's give him a year more growth? What's going on?
Well, I can only speak, you know, I have a first grader, second grader, and third grader. So I'm living this
right
now.
You're right there.
And two of my children have July birthdays. And I will tell you, there's so much to be thinking about right now in how they're going to do. Are they going to be socially accepted? Are they going to be socially mature enough? The last thing was on my mind was their, you know, their performance as a high school athlete. But I would imagine that is a consideration for some parents. I think, you know, you hear this anecdotally more with boys than you do with girls. And oftentimes boys are several months delayed and they're behind in their development from girls. But I think one of the questions that you've got to ask is if you do decide to hold your child back, what's going to happen in that year period? What hold them back to what end? And what experience are they going to have in that year that's going to better equip them when they enter at six? And one could argue that so if it's social, emotional, if it's academic, there may be no better place to start to equip them with the skills that you're hoping they acquire than a kindergarten classroom.
Your group represents teachers. What do teachers find? Is it difficult, more difficult to teach a class that has, we'll have some 4-year-olds and some almost 7-year-olds in it? Is it fair to the rest of the class?
Yeah. So NAYC, we are from birth to age 8. So we have infant toddler teachers up through third grade teachers in our membership. And like I said, the kindergarten is this interesting moment where there's this large transition. And I think kindergarten teachers who go into this field and into this profession are expecting some variability. It's, you know,
sure.
We talk a lot about developmentally appropriate practice, and that means meeting children regardless of the standards or because of the standards, meeting children where they're at, knowing individual child development and learning, knowing what's individually appropriate, knowing what's culturally appropriate, taking into account the experiences that children have had prior to kindergarten or experiences they haven't had, quite frankly. And so I think early childhood educators are expecting variability. I think given
the more
the
holding
range
back
of 4
we have,
to 7
the more variability.
Right. So from 4 to 7 is a large difference in development for a young child.
My question was, is it fair to the rest of the class then if it creates an unwieldy range of ages?
I think teachers for the most part are equipped to deal with the range. I think parents have to struggle with whether or not individual parents have to struggle with whether or not long term it's the right thing to do for their children. I mean, think about maybe they will be the star of the football team. I think as a parent, I think, my 13-year-old daughter is going to be in classes in junior high classes with 16-year-old boys. That's an interesting mix.
Yes, it mixes it up all the way through. I guess that's right. Rhian Evans-Alvin, please stand by in Washington. With us from New York is Sarah Gonzer, a mother who redshirted her son. Son's now in second grade, freelance writer. She wrote about it. Sarah, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You wrote a column about redshirting your son, holding him back. You got an awful lot of kickback on this. This is more controversial than I knew. What were the kind of complaints you got from others about this, Sarah?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point because I was talking to a friend this morning and she, you know, held her son back as well. And she and I both agreed that, you know, among all the parents we've known who've held their kid back for a year, no one regrets it. It was the absolute best thing to do. The people who get really emotional about it are often the parents of, and I'm kind of generalizing here, but they're often the parents of both the smallest kid in the class, and I totally get that. It's hard to be the youngest and the smallest. When my kids started kindergarten, there were 2 4-year-olds, and they were almost half the size of the rest of the class. But in his class, almost everyone was either 5 1/2 or already 6.
So that meant a lot of people were redshirting, holding their kids back. But you started your essay on this off saying, you know, before anyone jumps down my throat, you were ready for people to be skeptical about it. You said it had nothing to do with dreams of a stellar athletic career or gaining an edge as the biggest kid in the class. So what was it about, Sarah?
When my kids started preschool, or I guess it was sort of play school at 2 1/2, he had some great teachers, and they observed him for that first year, and they sat us down, my husband and myself, and they said, you know, We think you should find a preschool where you will have the option to give him another year, just so he has enough time to mature emotionally and socially so that he can be comfortable in kindergarten. It has nothing to do. You know, your show, I'm seeing online here, it's called Gaining an Edge, Redshirting, Holding Kids Back for an Edge. It had nothing to do with gaining an edge. It had everything to do with making sure that he was prepared, that he was okay, that he could survive, that he, you know, that he wouldn't get the kind of start that would make him just tune out within a couple of years, tune out from school, and be one of those boys who just kind of hates school and can't deal with it and is overwhelmed and is the trouble kid.
And what about the research? And there's a lot of it out there now. It suggests a lot of different things, but a lot of them aren't necessarily positive, that it's the kids who are held back who can end up actually tuning out, actually dropping out in high school, having some lower earnings later on. Do you worry about those in your son's case?
No, I don't worry about their earnings at all. I worry about him being happy, about him being comfortable, challenged, interested. And he is all those things right now. I can't predict, you know, how he will be 10 years, 20 years down the road, but you can't do that for anyone. And, you know, maybe he'll... It's all a big question mark, and we made the decision. You know, another thing I think is important to think about is that it's really a case-by-case kind of thing. I mean, it's very hard to generalize. I haven't even met anyone who kept their kid for another year in preschool so that their kid could be, you know, on the athletic team, or I don't know anyone who's done that. Everyone I know who's made this decision, it was about just not being mature enough. And it wasn't about an edge. It was about being on par with the others.
Sarah Gonzer, I appreciate you joining us for a couple of minutes today to share your decision with us. Thanks a lot for being here.
Yeah, thanks.
Good luck to you and your son, Sarah Gonzer, there in New York. Let's go to the research on this. David Deming joins us right now, professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and co-author with Susan Donarski of a big study that looked at across a lot of research at the outcomes in cases where children were redshirted or held back in kindergarten. David Deming, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Walk us into your findings. I guess you looked at many research efforts and did some pulling together. Help us understand what you found in terms of outcomes when children are held back from kindergarten.
Sure. So our paper, Tom, was really about trying to document the trend in the increasing redshirting of kids, you know, kids being older for grade. One of the things we found was, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, the share of sixth graders enrolled in first grade or higher dropped from 96% to 83%.
Six-year-olds? Is that what you said?
Six-year-olds in first grade or higher. So Okay. That's our way of saying, because not everyone attends kindergarten, mm-hmm. We say, well, if you're in first grade at age six, you were in kindergarten age five or higher. And then there's been some later studies subsequent to ours that look directly at the incidence of redshirting and have found that it's definitely growing over time.
And what's the change again that you found there?
So it was 96% of kids in 1968. Six-year-olds were enrolled in first grade or higher.
Okay.
And it's down to 83% in 2010.
Oh, that's a big change.
It's a very big change, yes.
What about outcomes, David? At the other end of the pipeline, I see lots of different research reports here and a whole range of outcomes, as many negative as positive to my quick review.
Yes, it's a very mixed bag. And I think one of the reasons that's true, Tom, is because it's very hard to think about the right frame of reference. If you're looking at a child when they're 6 or 7 years old, as Rianne said, that's a really big – 1 year of age difference is a really big gap at that age. By the time people are older, it's really not. And so it's important to think about not to compare your kid to the people in their class, but to compare them to where they would have been if they were in an older or younger grade. Right. So when your child enters, you say, oh, well, they're the oldest. They're going to score higher on the test. But that's because they're older. It's not because they've been advantaged by the educational experience they've had of being the oldest in the class.
So
studies that look at the long run effect, so, you know, earnings in adulthood or test mm-hmm. scores in adolescence, generally find no impact of being older for your grade.
But I'm looking here, researchers at the University of Texas at Austin, University of Southern California, looked at a lot of data, 15,000 26-year-olds. They found redshirted kids performed worse on 10th grade tests, were twice as likely to drop out of school, were less likely to graduate from college, And they said the only advantage to redshirting was that redshirted kids were marginally more likely to play varsity sports in high school. That doesn't sound like a great vote of support for doing it, David.
That's right. I mean, I guess I would, for those, there's also another study. I would consider kind of the study with the best data on this actually comes from Sweden, where mm-hmm. In Sweden they have great data where they track everyone from birth. And they were able to find that basically by the time you're an adult relative, you know, kids who are relatively old for their grade actually have slightly lower earnings in adulthood. So I think, yeah, the evidence on the benefits of it mostly comes from studies that kind of stop early in life and don't look later on. And of course, as a parent, that's when you're making the decision, and that's when it's most salient to you.
But stopping at 26 is already enough time to look at a lot of things. If it's true that they perform worse on 10th grade tests, more likely to drop out of high school, less likely to graduate from college, that's pretty arresting and kind of hard to understand.
Right. Well, so one of the things to remember is so the studies that look at a high school dropout are typically focused on kids who are dropping out at the age of compulsory schooling. So you can, in many states, you have to stay in school until you're 16, 17, 18 years old. But if you're in a younger grade when you're 16, then you can drop out in, let's say, 9th grade rather than 10th grade. And so that's what those studies are identifying. And yet for parents who are, you know, that we're talking about, you know, higher income parents, parents who are thinking about this competitive edge, that's often not the thing that's really binding. You know, you're not, most of those children are not dropping out at the age of compulsory schooling. So it's really two different cases, which may explain the disparate results.
And what about from your review of the research? I'm reading here one summary says that you concluded redshirted kids tend to have lower IQs and earnings as adults. Is that true, and why?
I don't believe we concluded that. I mean, our study was a review of other evidence. I don't think there's no study that documents lower IQ, certainly that I'm aware of.
This is the summary of your research that Slate reported. They got it wrong?
Well, our paper was really a review of other studies. I have to admit, Tom, I went over my paper last night to do some homework to make sure I was getting everything right. And I don't think that we certainly didn't find that. And I'm not aware of any other studies that do. But as you say, as the other guest said, the evidence is very mixed.
Rhian Evans-Alvin, when parents come in and say, what should I do, how do you recommend teachers respond?
Well, most teachers will take time to talk with parents and with, talk with children even. And I think it brings up a really interesting moment in time for a child and a family, this transition between their early childhood years and their formal academic experience is bumpy. We have not created systems that have aligned these experiences. So in a perfect world, particularly for children who've been in formal early learning settings, there's a lot of good observational data, work sampling, documentation on what that child's experience social, emotionally, physically, fine and gross motor skills, cognitively, linguistically, what their experience was as a 3- and 4-year-old. And in a perfect world, a kindergarten teacher can look at that evidence as part of it. But because we've created such separate, disparate systems in early learning and K-12 education, that's a hard connection right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about academic redshirting. That is, families holding their young children back from starting kindergarten, usually for a year. Controversy over it, whether it's a good idea. David Deming is with us from Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Rhian Evans-Alvin is with us, Executive Director of the National Association for the Education of Young Children. David, Rhian, we've got so many callers. I've been keeping them waiting. Let me go to them. Tommy in Lebanon, Tennessee. Tommy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to relay my experience. My wife and I had our boys in August. They were born in August, and we had that option to hold them out.
Mm-hmm.
We did. My oldest was a 15-year-old high school freshman, was an 18-year-old senior the day he showed up for his senior year in high school. My 14, it will be going through that same process as he's a 8th grader today.
And what's your sense of it, Tommy? How it's worked out for them?
It has been tremendous. They have both been very mature young men, and they have been big helps to their teachers. And in fact, every educator my wife and I spoke to about this on the front end said, mm-hmm. hey, if you get a chance to hold them out, do it. boys need that. And it has been a big help for both of my kids. My oldest is in junior college playing baseball now, graduated as an honor student, and my youngest is well on track to do the same thing.
So what do you take from that? Well, should we hold them all back then, Tommy? Should we be moving the start date back later for everybody?
I'd say if you have the means and if your child is born late in the year where that is going to be a viable option, I say go for it. And we were very fortunate in that we had a Mother's Day Out program at our local church where child care was not an issue. Both my wife and I work, but she had a day off at the front end of the week, and I had a day off in the back end of the week.
Made it work.
It worked, and it was something we would certainly do again. I think boys in particular need that.
Tommy, I appreciate your call. Rianne, what are you thinking as Tommy lays out his family's story there and his sort of blanket advice?
He brings up some great points, and I think this goes back to he and his wife having options other than kindergarten. Again, if you are going to hold your child back, what is it that you want that child to know and be able to do and understand, or the growth that child needs to make in the year? And I think you talked about the income disparity. A lot of parents don't have that option. The great program that he talks about at his church, but that it's hard to find inexpensive child care. Most child care preschool programs are between $7,000 and $12,000 a year per child, and so it isn't even an option for many parents.
$7,000 to $12,000 and up, way up in many cases. What do you think, David, of this trend then, where the affluent, and we're seeing this in some of the studies here, tend to be doing this significantly more than otherwise? Tommy made it work regardless, but what about that difference, David?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that, you know, every parent knows their child better than any researcher. There is no researcher on planet Earth that can tell you what to do with your own child. But if you're asking me whether redshirting is a good thing for society, I think it isn't. And the reason is because it's a zero-sum game. Someone has to be the youngest in the class. And so if everyone whose child is born in August holds their kid back a year, then everyone whose child is who's born in July is going to say, wow, my kid is the youngest in the class, and hold them back. And then everyone whose child is born in June is going to do the same thing. And at some point, someone has to be the youngest. And so, yes, absolutely, if you have the means, you can do it as a personal decision. And there's nothing wrong with that as a personal decision. But I think as a society, we do have to think about what are the larger consequences of doing this.
You know, I'm reading here in a Wall Street Journal report, Rianne, people in this world saying, well, sooner or later, your kid's going to ask why they're the oldest one, and it could actually hurt their self-esteem if you say, well, I thought you needed the extra time.
Yes, and I'm not familiar specifically with that report. I think in general, I think my sense is that, and this is anecdotal, that children are less cognizant of this competition than the adults in their lives are, or the decisions that they're making. And so I think if the adults in a child's life, their parents, who David points out, are absolutely the first and best decision makers on this, their parents, their teachers, their counselors, you know, are making these decisions on behalf of young children, I think they just have to take into account not just what's happening when they're 5, but what's happening when they're 10 and they're 15 and they're 18. And the other thing I would say, Tom, is the role schools play just as an institution. You know, with some of the academic rigor that folks are talking about, you know, I think sometimes parents inadvertently get messages, or very explicit messages, here's what your child has to be doing by the time they get to kindergarten. Your child has to be an avid reader, or your child has to know their ABCs. And when parents get those messages from schools, that, I mean, I know I'm a parent, that would weigh into the decision I was making on whether or not my son or daughter was ready for kindergarten.
But David's looking at this and seeing that ultimately that somebody gets the short end of the stick here. Somebody has to be youngest in class. It's zero sum. And if it boils down to whether you can afford another year of preschool for your kids, is this just another element, promoting inequality, even multi-generational inequality in our society, Rianne?
I think we have to remember that it's still a small percentage of children that their parents are choosing to redshirt them. So the bulk of children are entering, the vast majority of children are still entering kindergarten when they would typically enter kindergarten. And I would again say, Tom, I genuinely don't think this would be as big of an issue if every child in this country had access to high-quality early learning experiences. The variability would change dramatically if that were the case. And so we're talking about redshirting kindergartens. We're 5 years in, kindergartners, we're 5 years in at that point after a child has not had access to high-quality child care, not had a preschool experience, maybe not had great early learning opportunities in their home, maybe had a family who's struggling vulnerably financially, or didn't have access to health care, quite frankly, to well child checks and to well baby checks, and they can't read because they've had chronic ear infections the first 5 years of their life. And so, you know, that all compounds into how these decisions are made with kindergartners and five-year-olds.
Response online here. Ellie says, I fought redshirting my son. As long as he had the academic skills, he belonged in grade. Robin says, talking about her son whose birthday was August 1st, we didn't redshirt him, but we should have. Dee asks, why do we need to lockstep them at all? David, what about that? People who say, well, let's, you know, remember the little schoolhouse on the prairie where kids of all age were in there and just going at their own speed. Why not do that?
I think that's certainly an option. I think one of the things that's, you know, and some of your previous guests alluded to this is it's driving this is an increased sense of competitiveness. So as a parent, you know, you mentioned, Tom, that that people used to brag about kids, you know, skipping a grade, and that never happens.
Being the youngest.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, many of us have, you know, mothers who skip grades or know people who skip grades in the previous generation.
Point of pride back there.
Exactly. And so the shift is focused, you know, the focus has shifted from not, you know, my child is ahead and how much they're learning, but my child is beating the other children. And I think, you know, it's something that it's a feeling that you get that's hard to fight, you know. So if other people are every month that people start to redshirt their children just makes it so that your child, you know, you might not want to do it yourself, but if you have children who are 15, 16 months older than your child, it gets to be a harder and harder sell. And so I think as a society, we should try to think about, is there a way to arrest this increase in competitiveness in early grades?
Kim in Austin, Texas. Thanks for calling, Kim. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you doing today?
Well,
I wanted to just make the comment that I did hold my son back, and it was the best thing I ever did. And we did put him in a Montessori school for the first year, which was a combined kindergarten first grade class. So then we ended up moving, and he went on to kindergarten in another school. But he did ask me at one point why I did that, and I told him, you know, I thought he needed it, and it was a maturity thing, and he accepted that, and he was okay. And now he's getting a second master's degree, and he's thriving. So he wants to be an astronaut.
Did you ever have second thoughts about it, Kim, along the way for him individually or not?
No, I did not. Not at all. In fact, in eighth grade, I went through a divorce when he was in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had been in another grade, the ninth grade,
yep,
I think it would have been much more difficult for him. That was a tough year.
And what about David Deming's point that if more people begin doing this, it puts pressure on everybody to consider doing it, even though people may not all have the means to do it, even though not all kids ought to do it?
Well, there has to be a cutoff. I mean, you can't have, you know, I think he was born in July. So, I mean, I think there's a reasonable amount of time there that would be acceptable. But, I mean, particularly for boys, I think they just need that. Their maturity level is just not there.
Kim's son on his way. He hopes to be an astronaut. Kim, thanks for your call from Austin. Let me get one more here. Winthrop, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
A couple of years ago on your show, you ran an excellent piece on how educational outcomes in two countries that couldn't be more different are number one and two in the world. There was Finland and there was South Korea.
Yes.
Finland, You probably remember from the research for the piece, doesn't start formal schooling until the age of 7. Now, we just had a boy of ours turn 5 in August.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a younger sister who's about 3.5. She's 4 in January. And we had the boy, the 5-year-old, enrolled in kindergarten to start this academic year. At the last minute, we pulled him out and sent him to preschool with his younger sister.
Okay.
And the reason that we did that is because, you see, there's, with the advent of big data, there's a neurosis about outcomes. But when you see our two kids playing together. They just want to be together. And when I was a kid, I went to a homeschool cooperative with my siblings, who were all of obviously different ages, mm-hmm. and we were all together. And as a result, we're very close as adults. We have enduring friendships for our whole lives. And you see, I strongly believe that at this stage in life, we shouldn't be making decisions about our children's lives now based on outcomes that are so far in the future that I know that there is research, but it seems like the relationship is so remote and there are so many other chances to intervene that it doesn't make sense to make a decision right now that hobbles my child or my children socially so that I can achieve some sort of vague notion of an outcome later on. And I know that that's not what everybody is coming from. That's not how everybody approaches the calculus, and that's fine.
No, I love it, Steve. That's wonderful nuance that you give us there, especially when you cite the research, but the research is decidedly ambiguous on whether it's advantageous or not. I appreciate your call, and we'll look at it. Rianne, what about Steve's approach here? Is he, you know, in a way, he wants more of that early childhood cuddly togetherness in the family and is willing to hold his son back to have some more of that, you know, outcomes 10 years, 12 years down the road, be damned.
Mm. Two thoughts. First off, I think Finland's a really interesting example because there is a lot of talk about Finland and such great outcomes. Again, I would say you've got to look at what happens before age 8 in Finland and the access that families have, all families have in Finland, to high-quality early learning experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. The second thing I would say is really, again, what's happening in the kindergarten classroom and what parents are worried about or concerned about. You know, when it was a long time ago that I was in kindergarten, but when I remember moments of my kindergarten experience and, you know, dramatic play and negotiating with peers and learning the basics of how to be a good learner. And I remember my mom coming in and fixing green eggs and ham while I read the book. And I think a lot of people have images now of a kindergarten that is very different and that has children, again, focused on academic learning at the peril of their development. And I think Steve points that out. So, but that's not always the case, which is why I think it's really important when parents are making this decision to go in and observe the kindergarten classrooms where their children will be attending. Many kindergarten classrooms, their kindergarten teachers know how to maintain developmentally appropriate practice. So there's still small group time. There's still negotiation. There's still peers learning from one another, being infused with challenging standards, which is what we at NAYC believe is really important. And so I think part of the decision making has to be kind of not going by the stereotypes you have in your mind, but actually observing what's happening in kindergarten classrooms.
David, is it possible that kindergarten has changed in a way that makes it harder for younger students, that more testing oriented, I don't know, less intimate, more academic, more structured?
There's a lot of evidence that it has, Tom, actually. So people have done studies where they go back and look at the curricula for kindergarten. And basically, you know, kindergarten is sort of the new first grade. So the things that we expected first graders to do, you know, 20 years ago, we now expect kindergartners to do. There's a lot more focus on ABCs, the academics, things like that. And I think that's definitely driving some of this trend. But if you look, you know, so I am the parent of a new kindergartner myself. And when I walk into the kindergarten classroom, you know, it's obvious immediately there's so much else going on that's so much more rich than just whether you know your ABCs.
You know, if you look at the reporting on this, I have to say, from this conversation, you can imagine everybody who can afford it running out and trying to do it. But the research that I've seen reported shows such mixed results, I'm not sure it's all at all a good idea. But if people go that way, David, you know what it's going to be. It's going to be affluent people holding their kids back and other people not holding them back. And here we go again in America on different tracks. Not good.
It's a very difficult situation for parents out there. I mean, I'll tell you that I have a child who was born in July, and we elected not to redshirt her, although we certainly felt the temptation. And I think part of it is just, you know, you have to take a step off the treadmill and not worry so much about competitiveness when a child is 5 years old. You know, even if you are competitive, what's going on now with your child at age 5 is not likely to be very related to what's happening with them at age 16, 17, and 18 when they're actually, you know, applying to college and things like that. And so I just think One way to handle this, would be to do what many other countries do, which is to specify a minimum starting age and a maximum starting age. So you have to be, you know, 5 by September 1st, but no more than 6. And so your birthday perfectly determines which year you enroll in kindergarten. That would be one way to do it.
Rian, for parents who are thinking about this actively in the year ahead, what's a question or two or three they ought to put to maybe the kindergarten teacher?
Absolutely. So I think the kindergarten teacher can help assess the child's social-emotional development to say, I'm worried about this. Here's what my concerns are. And the kindergarten teacher can help a parent navigate those decisions.
And are they ready and willing to do that in general? If you come in, is there a chance for parents to do that?
Absolutely. As I said, I have a first, second, and third grader. I am living this, and every experience I have had has been one where I have found their teachers to be partners in my making decisions.
Well, there's no cut and dried answer here. Many ways to go. You do not have to wait to do very well. That's clear. And in some cases, may even do worse. We'll get some of those stories up at our website later today where you can check out the research. Rian Evans-Alvin with the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And David Deming at Harvard Graduate School of Education. Thank you, David.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.